Okay, so we are in Deuteronomy 33, and we're not leaving till we're done with the book. verse 1, this is the blessing which Moses, the man of God, blessed the people of Israel before his death. There are 12 sections of this. One of the tribes is missing from the list, but there's somebody else that comes in his own section. Verse 2.
He said, the Lord came from Sinai and dawned from Seir upon us. He shone forth from Mount Paran. He came from the 10,000s of holy ones with flaming fire at his right hand.
Mm-hmm. And that is Mount Sinai. The images and pictures of Mount Sinai. And the angels attending and flaming fire. Verse 3, yes, he loved his people. All his holy ones were in his hand. So they followed in your steps, receiving direction from you. Notice the change in person from third person to second person. And that happens frequently in the Old Testament. And then there's another person speaking. Verse 4.
Moses commanded a law for us, a heritage of the congregation of Jacob.
Okay. Is that perhaps in the voice of Joshua, who is part of the writing of this? Verse 5, thus the Lord became king in Jeshurun. When the heads of the people were gathered, all the tribes of Israel together. And there the term Jeshurun is used in its proper sense, not sarcastically, the righteous ones. So God sets up Israel as the righteous ones, and he is their king. Now we go through the tribes. Verse 6.
Let Reuben live and not die, but let his men be few.
Okay. The tribe of Reuben will be preserved, but Reuben would not be one of the larger tribes. There's a tribe missing at this point, because it should be that one next instead of Judah. But that one was absorbed into the tribe of Judah when the territory was divided. They simply took a portion of the... Deb's missing.
Simeon?
Yeah, she's
so is,
watching.
So is...
Norma.
Norma's there, she's listening.
So is Lois.
Deb and Lois are watching on her computer because she's having her phone freeze up.
Ah. Okay.
She's having trouble with the phone freezing since
the
put in the new...
The tribe that is linked into Judah is Simeon. And if you look through the maps of the 12 tribes, what you'll notice is Simeon's kind of listed in there within the tribe of the territory of Judah. So, verse 7. And this he said of Judah, hear, O Lord, the voice of Judah, and bring him into his people. With your hands contend for him, and be a help against his adversaries. Now, back in Genesis 49, which this refers back to constantly, for Judah it was said, the staff will not depart from Judah until it comes to whom it belongs. And I just blipped on the last phrase of that. And to him, until tribute comes to him, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. or until it comes to Shiloh. And that's a whole mix of different strands of statements intended to be ambiguous and intended to all be true. Shiloh for peace, Jesus being our peace. Okay. Verse 8.
And of Levi, he said, give to Levi your thummim and your Urim to God to your godly one, whom you tested at Massah, with whom you quarreled at the waters of Meribah.
So, Levi is the tribe that when the golden calf happened, they were the ones that came to Moses and reestablished the discipline in the congregation. Their loyalty was to God, and they became the tribe set apart for God's use, for God's worship, the worship of God, for the service of God. Verse 9, who said of his father and mother, I regard them not. He disowned his brothers and ignored his children, for they observed your word and kept your covenant. So which comes first in the family? Loyalty to the family, defending your children, or the truth? And that's the question, isn't it? And in our day, it's shifted away from the truth. And it's gone to, my children, my family above everything. And even if your children are in the wrong and acting up and defending against everything, I've seen people stick up for their children because, well, they're my children. What am I supposed to do? Discipline them. They have to know how to walk with God. And that is more important than anything else in life. Open this up for comments on that point, because this is so important.
Who is talking in verse 9? Who is he? He said.
Of Levi, he said. This is at the end of the Pentateuch, and Delitzsch clued me in on that the Jewish people believe that Moses finished his actual writing of the five books to hand it over to the Levites in chapter 31, verse 24. When Moses had finished writing the words of this law in a book to the very end, Moses commanded the Levites who carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, take this book of the law and put it by the side of the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God, that it may be there for a witness against you. The song that Moses and God and Joshua wrote got placed next to that later on. When you get to chapter 33, the Jewish rabbis pretty much all believe that this is somebody else providing the framework of commentary. It is Moses's words when the quotes are there, but when it says he said, that is somebody else acting as the editor at this point. And a faithful editor will allow the words of the person to stand speak through the framework, but there's necessary editing. So when it says, and of Levi he said, that's an editor's note. And then when it gives the quote, those are the words of Moses. And that's what the rabbis have believed for nearly forever.
So when it's a nine, when it said, he said of his father and mother, I have no regard for them.
Okay, that is Moses' words.
And Moses is talking about Levi's father
mother? About Levi. But I guess you kind of have to assume that from verse 7 to verse 8, it would sound like this as Moses spoke it. Hear, O Lord, the voice of Judah, and bring him into his people. With your hands contend for him, and be a help against his adversaries. Give to Levi your Thummim and your Urim to your godly one. If you want to hear it as Moses spoke it, you would have to drop the introduction to each section. Mm-hmm. And that's provided there, it's fair use, so that the reader knows who's next. Does this make this not the words of Moses? No, it doesn't. It means you have somebody doing a faithful editing job to provide the headings and nothing more.
I find that whole passage very confusing. Mm-hmm. When it says he did not recognize his brothers or acknowledge his own children.
Now, when the incident happened with the golden calf, do you spare somebody because you're related to them?
Oh,
or do you execute judgment because they have done wrong? Mm. And way back when, all through from Exodus on, God has made this point. Be not a respecter of persons. Let the judge judge what is right and what is wrong, not by relationship, not by blood, not by bribes that are given, not by prominence in the community. The judge should neither favor the rich because they're rich, nor favor the poor because they are disadvantaged, but should judge with justice and in truth. And anything else than that perverts justice. That is the unified witness in the books of Moses and on through the books of the Old Testament and on into the New Testament. Where somebody comes to Jesus and says, Rabbi, that we know that you are no respecter of persons. What does that mean? Does Jesus have no respect for anybody? That's not what it means. It means if you're going to say what is right and wrong, what is true and false, you're not going to temper your words because they might get mad, or because they're a personal friend, or because of their position in the community, or because of things that have happened badly to them in the past. What is true is true. What is false. What is just, what is unjust. If you are to be judged innocent, that is on the basis of that you are innocent. If you are to be judged guilty, that is on the basis that you are guilty. And it doesn't matter to the Levites in that instance. If your favorite son was involved in doing this thing with the golden calf, and the command was to execute those who had done certain specific things and not just followed along, and your favorite son had done that, your hand would not hesitate, because justice and truth has to be held, because if it is not held, then the whole thing collapses. And that's true in our day. If truth is not truth, the whole thing collapses. If there is a bias to be built in to our justice system, the whole thing collapses. That is something that the Bible is extremely strident about. Does that all make sense?
Yes. So this is like a prayer that Moses is saying to God for the different tribes.
And actually, yes, in part it becomes a prayer, but it is a blessing. A blessing is speaking what are to be the fortunes in the future, inspired by God, calling out to God to witness and calling on God to fulfill what seems to be his will by the revelation that he's given to Moses. And it is Jacob and it is Moses who are able to speak these things. Before Jacob, it was Isaac. Before Isaac, it was Abraham who gave blessings. And before Abraham, who was it that gave the blessing? That would be God. So it is a bit of a mix that moves back and forth between being a call out to God to fulfill these things and a revelation of truth. In verse 9, it is, these things are blessings to Levi because he held to justice. He held to truth. Fair enough?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then verse 10 is addressed to God. Verse 10.
Teaches your precepts to Jacob and your law to Israel. He offers incense before you and whole burnt offerings on your altar.
Mm-hmm. Bless, O Lord, his substance and accept the work of his hands. Crush the loins of his adversaries, of those who hate him, that they rise not again. Again, truth. Verse 12.
Of Benjamin, he said, the beloved of the Lord dwells in safety. The high God surrounds him all day long, dwells between his shoulders.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I had to look up, dwells between his shoulders.
Would that be his head?
He dwells between the shoulders of Jehovah is equivalent to on the back. He's carried along. The expression is a figure of a father carrying his son. By no means so bold as that of the eagle's wings, but there you are. The whole nation participated in the blessing which Moses desired for Benjamin. And all Israel, like Benjamin, was the beloved of the Lord and dwelt with him in safety. So, the interpretation Delitzsch gives reverses the persons there, that it is Benjamin who dwells between the shoulders of God rather than God dwelling between the shoulders of Benjamin. We better go on. Verse 13, and of Joseph he said, blessed by the Lord be his land with the choicest gifts of heaven above, and of the deep that crouches beneath, verse 14.
With the choicest fruits of the sun and the rich yield of the months.
with the finest produce of the ancient mountains and the abundance of the everlasting hills. Verse 16.
With the precious things of the earth and its fullness and the favor of him who dwelt in the bush. Let the blessing come on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of him who was separate from his brothers.
Mm-hmm. A firstborn bull, he has majesty, and his horns are the horns of a wild ox. With them he shall gore the peoples, all of them to the ends of the earth. They are the 10,000s of Ephraim, and they are the thousands of Manasseh. So Ephraim was to be the more prominent of the two sons of Joseph. He was blessed with some of the richest land in all of the Holy Land, and was very prosperous and very numerous. And, his blessings went out so that they could spread to the whole earth. The peoples that rose up against the people of God, God would give him strength and power to defeat them. Verse 18.
About Zebulun, he said, rejoice, Zebulun, in your going out, and you, Issachar, in your tents.
Oh, so he's combined two tribes there, and Zebulun and Issachar kind of hung together. Verse 19, they shall call peoples to their mountain. There they offer right sacrifices. For they draw from the abundance of the seas and the hidden treasures of the sand. And
do you have everything from downstairs?
Yeah, I do. So it'd just be a service call and then a little bit of labor. So it's usually $95 for a service call right around the corner, and then probably $20 in labor. So it'd be
okay. Zebulun and Issachar are the last two sons of Levi. Moses unites them together like Jacob in Genesis 49, places Zebulun the younger first, like Jacob in Genesis 49. He confirms the blessings which Jacob promised through simply interpreting their names and calling upon them to rejoice in the undertakings at home and abroad, at your tents, at your going out, sitting and going out and coming in, describes the life in its two aspects of work and production, rest and relaxation, or recreation. Rejoice, Zebulun and Issachar, in your labor and your rest. Poetic parallelism, distributing to the parallel members what has been given to both. So the shipping trade and the commercial pursuits and the nomadic life of tents, the good things of life would flow to them in rich abundance. They would not make them into mammon, however, but would invite nations to the mountain there to offer sacrifices of righteousness. By the mountain of the Lord's inheritance upon which the Lord was about to plant his people. And that's general and broad at this point because God had not told them specifically which mountain it would be. That was for later revelations. Okay, that's enough for them. Where are we to?
20.
Gad, verse 20.
And of Gad, he said, blessed be he who enlarges Gad. Gad crouches like a lion, he tears off arm and scalp.
You know what? He chose.
Understand?
He chose the best of the land for himself, for there a commander's portion was reserved. And he came with the heads of the people. With Israel, he executed the justice of the Lord and his judgments for Israel. So Gad was, I believe, one of those that was on the eastern side. Yeah, the kingdom of Sion, an unlimited space for his development. And the lion-like nature revealed itself in conflict with his foes. The Gadites were very good warriors. So east of the Jordan, and is there anything else? Oh, yeah. Of the tribes east of the Jordan, the tribe of Gad became the prominent one, the leader tribe of those. And then we move on. Verse 22.
I don't think we read 21, did we?
Well, let me read 21. He chose the best of the land for himself, for there a commander's portion was reserved. And he came with the heads of the people. With Israel, he executed the justice of the Lord and his judgments for Israel. So the across the Jordan tribes became a thing, and the tribe of Gad was the most prominent. And then to verse 22.
And of Dan, he said, Dan is a lion's cub that leaps from Bashan, however.
Mm-hmm. And young lion, which springs out. Back in Genesis 49, Jacob compared him to a serpent by the way, who strikes suddenly. Moses gives greater prominence to the strength of Dan. In the regions of eastern Bashan, which abound with caves, and then in the woody western slopes of Jebel Haran, many lions harbored, which rushed forth from the thicket and were very dangerous enemies to the herds of Bashan. So that's probably why the particular imagery is chosen. 23. And of Naphtali, he said, O Naphtali, sated with favor and full of the blessings of the Lord, possess the lake and the south. And that simply is, assures the tribe of Naphtali of God's blessings. Verse 24.
And of Asher, he said, Asher is most blessed of sons. Let him be favored by his brothers, and let him dip his foot in oil.
Oh, really? What's that mean, let him dip his foot in oil? Your bars shall be iron and bronze, and as your days, so shall your strength be. Dipping the foot in oil points to a land flowing with oil. That means fat or fertile throughout, which Jacob had already promised to Asher. The bars and the bolts, code expression for a castle or fortress. Asher's dwellings were to be fortresses of iron and brass. Which leads then, verse 26 begins the conclusion of the blessing. 26 to 29. So verse 26.
And there is none like God, O Jeshurun, who rides through the heavens to your help, through the skies in his majesty.
Mm-hmm. Jeshurun is a vocative. God of Jeshurun. Okay. Oh, yes. God who rides through the heavens to your help. It's time for a little field trip. To the book of Ezekiel. Got to put my bookmark in place for coming back. But Ezekiel, because this is a good opportunity to explain the imagery there. Starts in Ezekiel 1, verse 4. There's a lot. As I looked, behold, a stormy wind came out of the north, and a great cloud with brightness around it, and fire flashing forth continually, and in the midst of the fire, as it were, gleaming metal. And from the midst of it came the likeness of four living creatures, and this was their appearance. They had a human likeness, but each had four faces, and each of them had four wings. Their legs were straight, and the soles of their feet were like the sole of a calf's foot, and they sparkled like burnished bronze. Under their wings, on their four sides, they had human hands, and the four had their faces and their wings thus. Their wings touched one another. Each one of them went straight forward without turning as they went. As for the likeness of their faces, each had a human face. The four had the face of a lion on the right side, and the four had a face of an ox on the left side, and the four had the face of an eagle. Such were their faces, and their wings were spread out above. Each creature had two wings, each of which touched the wing of another, while two covered their bodies, and each went straight forward. Wherever the spirit would go, they went without turning as they went. As for the likeness of the living creatures, their appearance was like burning coals of fire, like the appearance of torches moving to and fro among the living creatures. And the fire was bright, and out of the fire went forth lightning, and the living creatures darted to and fro like the appearance of a flash of lightning. Now, as I looked at the living creatures, I saw a wheel on the earth beside the living creatures, one for each of the four of them. As for the appearance of the wheels and their construction, their appearance was like the gleaming of beryl. And the four had the same likeness, their appearance and the construction being, as it were, a wheel within a wheel. When they went in any of their four directions without turning as they went. And their rims were tall and awesome, and the rims of all four were full of eyes all around. And when the living creatures went, the wheels went beside them. And when the living creatures rose from the earth, the wheels rose. Wherever the spirit wanted to go, they went, and the wheels rose along with them, for the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. Then when those went, these went, and when those stood still, these stood, and when those rose from the earth, the wheels rose along with them, for the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. Over the heads of the living creatures, there was the likeness of an expanse, shining like awe-inspiring crystal spread out above their heads. And under the expanse, their wings were stretched out straight, one toward another. And each creature had two wings covering its body. And when they went, I heard the sound of their wings like the sound of many waters, like the sound of the Almighty, a sound of tumult like the sound of an army. When they stood still, they let down their wings. And there came a voice from above the expanse over their heads. When they stood still, they let down their wings. And above the expanse over their heads, there was the likeness of a throne in appearance like sapphire. And seated above the likeness of the throne was a likeness with a human appearance. And upward from what had the appearance of his waist, I saw it, as it were, gleaming metal, like the appearance of fire enclosed all around. And downward from what had the appearance of his waist, I saw, as it were, the appearance of fire. and there was brightness around him, like the appearance of the bow that is in the cloud on the day of rain, so was the appearance of the brightness all around. Such was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. And when I fell at it, and when I saw it, I fell on my face, and I heard the voice of one speaking. So, yeah, that was long. That is known in Jewish theology as the chariot theology. In Hebrew, it's Merkavoth theology. And what it means is that the chariot of the Lord is where God's power is exercised. And Ezekiel sees this because the power of the Lord and the authority of the Lord and the might of the Lord and the glory of the Lord is exercised all over the earth. And he is the one who rides in through the heavens for the people, for the help of his people. If you're curious to keep on going with Ezekiel, then you would turn to chapter 10, where Ezekiel sees the vision, but it is in clearer focus in chapter 10. Because in chapter 1, Ezekiel has no idea what he's seeing. But after the revelations of chapters 2 through 9, then he kind of knows a bit more what he is seeing. So the chariot of the Lord, and going back to Deuteronomy 33, verse 26, there is none like God, O Jeshurun, who rides through the heavens to your help, through the skies in his majesty. That was a long detour to give you kind of a fuller impact impression of what is in that one verse. Should we go on? Verse 27, the eternal God is your dwelling place. What's that make you?
Eternal.
Yeah, there you go. And underneath are the everlasting arms. And so, not only your dwelling place, but your help as well. Third line, and he thrust out the enemy before you and said, destroy. So God, who rides in the heavens, the Merkavoth theology, who comes to your help through the skies in his majesty, the eternal dwelling place that makes you eternal, underneath the everlasting arms, where his protection and his help is forever, and he judges the enemy and thrusts them out. Verse 28, therefore.
So Israel lived in safety. Jacob lived alone in a land of grain and wine, whose heavens dropped down dew.
Mm-hmm. Verse 29, happy are you, O Israel, who is like you? Exodus 15, the song by the sea, who is like you, O Lord? Now the same phrase is used of Israel because of their connection with God. Happy are you, O Israel, who is like you, a people saved by the Lord, the shield of your help, and the sword of your triumph. Your enemies shall come fawning to you, and you shall tread upon their backs. So, Moses' blessing. 15 minutes. Any question before we attack chapter 34?
Yeah, what happened to Simeon?
Simeon was absorbed into Judah. Mm. So Simeon is the part of Judah back in verse 7. In fact, I do need to mention this. We talk about the 10 northern tribes and the 10 northern tribes being carried away into captivity and then they're gone. But not so quick. There is Judah, there is Simeon, there is the tribe of Levi. They're working in the southern kingdom at the temple. There is the tribe of Benjamin that's very close in there and begins to link with the tribe of Judah. And when the northern tribes, that would be the other eight of them, began wandering off, there was a lot of people that left their homes in the north and went south because they didn't want to be a part of worshiping golden calves. That is something that if you keep your eyes open for it, when you get to that section, is it Chronicles or is it Samuel or Kings? But in there, you find a mention of those from tribe after tribe after tribe journeying south to make their home in Judah. Okay. Chapter 34. Then Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo to the top of Pisgah, which is opposite Jericho. And the Lord showed him all the land, Gilead as far as Dan. By the way, I was looking online for a picture, photos from the top of Mount Nebo, overlooking the Holy Land, overlooking from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean. And somebody said in these pictures, they said, on a clear day, you can see all of this. And then the camera pans over and there's cloud and fog and it's not a clear day. Kept looking. Never found a picture of on a clear day, only for those things that were closer. So I'm going to keep looking. There's got to be a picture of on a clear day. Verse 2.
All Naphtali, the land of Ephraim and Manasseh, all the land of Judah, as far as the western sea.
The Negev and the plain that is the valley of Jericho, the city of palm trees, as far as Zoar. And so Moses is able to see all of these things. And Delitzsch does say, this sight of every part of the land on the east and west was not an ecstatic vision, but a sight with the bodily eyes whose natural power of vision was miraculously increased by God to give Moses a glimpse at least of the glorious land which he was not to tread and delight his eye with a view of the inheritance intended for his people. And as I'm teaching confirmation this last weekend, question comes up, when Jesus returns and every eye will see him, how's that possible? The earth is round. How is it possible? I like Delitzsch's phrase. Natural power of vision miraculously increased by God. So he is able to do this. And when Jesus appears all over the world, people will, did you find a, no, that's, that shows some, but it's a little bit limited. You say, yeah, that's nice, but there's a much, much broader expanse that Moses is said to have seen than just that. So, verse 4.
Then the Lord said to him, this is the land I promised on oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob when I said, I will give it to you, your descendants. I've let you see it with your eyes, but you will not cross over into it.
Mm-hmm. So Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of the Lord. Okay. Verse 6.
He buried him. Oh, go ahead, Kathy.
Nope, you go ahead.
He buried him in Moab, in the valley opposite Beth Peor, but to this day no one knows where his grave is.
Okay. And a little idea that Delitzsch says some were coming up with is that Moses died on the top of Mount Nebo and God carried the dead body down. And he says, don't be silly. It says he was on Mount Nebo to see the land. And it says he was buried in the valley, but that doesn't mean that Moses did not walk with God down into the valley and there take his place where he would die and be buried. Another thing Delitzsch mentions is that with Mount Nebo, it is possible that a lot of the people of Israel camped at the foot of Mount Nebo could have looked out and seen him a long ways up the mountain before it was time for him to die. Nobody knows the place of his burial. Point one, because you don't revere Moses, you don't worship him, so you shouldn't know where his burial place is. Second, Delitzsch suggests that this was a preparation for the time when Moses would appear with Elijah, appearing to Jesus, suggests that his body may have been brought back to life. That's going one step further than I think you can be sure of being on solid footing, but it's a suggestion. We did read verse 6, didn't we?
Yes.
Okay. Moses was 120 years old when he died. His eye was undimmed and his vigor unabated. Yeah, that's the plan. That's my plan. Vigor unabated. And then a good long life and then a fairly quick decline. Verse 8.
The people of Israel wept for Moses in the plains of Moab 30 days. Then the days of weeping and mourning for Moses were ended.
Does anybody have any doubt whether this is written by somebody who's not Moses? There are some, and we call them biblical literalists, which is, this is not literal. This may be literalism, saying that since it is the book of Moses, Moses wrote this before he died and wrote it as a prophecy of what would happen after he died. And the rest of us are saying, wait a minute, just fair use. It doesn't call into question the rest of the book to say that somebody else wrote the description of after he died. That's in literature, it is fair use.
No different than someone writing a prologue to a novel.
Yeah.
Right.
Or an epilogue to an autobiography that details the death and the funeral of the person who wrote the autobiography. Nobody pretends that this is violating what an autobiography is. Okay. 30 days of weeping and mourning. Verse 9. And Joshua the son of Nun was full of the spirit of wisdom, for Moses had laid his hands on him. So the people of Israel obeyed him and did as the Lord had commanded Moses. That's the transition. And then some final thoughts. Verse 10.
And there has not arisen a prophet since in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face.
How long after that is it written? I mean, this could be a final editor generations later. Or just in the next generation. None like him for all the signs and wonders that the Lord sent him to do in the land of Egypt to Pharaoh and to all his servants and to all his land. Verse 12.
And for all the mighty power and all the great deeds of terror that Moses did in the sight of all Israel.
Okay. And so ends the book.
I found a video of Mount Nebo if you want to share it with them.
No, we're still here.
Yeah, they can't see what we're looking
at.
This
is Mount Nebo, reading from Deuteronomy 34.
Okay, I will share. Yeah,
but notice there's mist and fog and everything else in that video. That seems to be the permanent state of Mount Nebo.
Okay, so here it is.
This is Mount Nebo, reading from Deuteronomy 34. Then Moses climbed Mount Nebo from the plains of Moab to the top of Pisgah, across the Jericho. There the Lord showed him the whole land, from Gilead to Dan, all of Naphtali, the territory of Ephraim and Manasseh, all the land of Judah as far as the Western Sea, the Negev and the whole region of the Valley of Jericho, the city of palms as far as Zoar. Then the Lord said to him, this is the land I promised on oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob when I said, I give it to you and your descendants. I have not let you see it with your eyes, but you will not cross over into it. And Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in Moab, as the Lord had said. He buried him in Moab in the valley opposite Beth Peor. But to this day, no one knows where the grave is. Moses was 120 years old when he died, yet his eyes were not
dim. Can they still hear me?
His eyes were not weak.
Yep. Okay. So my question is, what is this? You pick a cloudy day?
Well, it's kind of clear on the top of the mountain.
And then there's clouds all over the place and mist and fog. And on a clear day, you can see all the way to, well, then go up the mountain on a clear day.
Doesn't look.
Or are there not too many clear days?
From the top of the mountain?
I don't know.
Yeah, you could be in the clouds.
It is.
Doesn't look like. It looks like desert.
I was going to say, it doesn't look like the land of milk and honey, does it?
and it's not like it's. Way too high for there to not be clouds. It's about 2,500 feet thereabouts. And, you know, the Rocky Mountains are 6,000, 8,000, 10,000, 12,000 feet. This is 2,500. So, I'm guessing that it's just the climate conditions there, that it's cloudy most of the time. Huh. Well, next week we start on Joshua. You know, what kind of a transition is it going to be from Moses to Joshua? And Joshua faithfully carrying things out, but he's not Moses. And that's all I have to say.